So I thought I would start. Oh, that sounds much better. I thought I would start with a. It's not really a poem, it's a statement by one of the early nuns. These. This book of wisdom from these nuns that woke, you know, that became enlightened in the early time of the Buddha. This one's by Subba, the goldsmith's daughter. She says, they all told me the same thing. There's only one way to be truly safe. Get as much as you can and hold on tight. We don't take greed seriously enough. I grew up in a house made of gold, so I ought to know. You see what it does to people slowly over time. It changes them. It takes over. And you find yourself saying, I'll learn to be generous. I'll give it all away. But first, I need a little bit more. So stop lying to yourself. See a clenched fist for what it is. Not tomorrow, not in 20 years, now. I am Subba, the goldsmith's daughter, eating whatever is offered, sleeping wherever I can. This is what freedom looks like. Not a bucket of coins buried out back. This is also pointing to mental formations. We're also pointing to what we just don't think of sankharas this way, but I'm hoping if we talk a little bit about practicing with sankharas instead of just understanding what sankharas are, then we can begin to see what it is that Subba is pointing to. Subba, and I'm going to read one at the end. But what I think Subba is pointing to is I think she's trying to say there is an energy that's pushing us. It's greed, and then the flip side of that is hatred. And this kind of way that we go through life deluded, like, okay, I'm going to work on that generosity. I'm going to work on it. But really, we're being pushed by greed. We're being pushed by aversion. And that we don't look at. And instead, we think of the promise of what we're going to do, what it's going to be like. And I think she's pointing to this idea that if we're going to practice with this, if we're going to awaken, then we're going to have to practice with this greed right now. We can't practice with it next year. We have to practice with it right now. And that is a lot of what the sankharas are pointing to. That first link of ignorance is really just the root of greed, hatred, and delusion pushing us into the present moment. So this is kind of weird because we're going to be practicing basically with something that has already happened. The implications of it is already here. Sankharas, this mental formation, is what's arising in the present moment out of the causes of the past. And so, in one way, you could think, in order to deal with sankharas, you got to practice before they get here. that does not make any sense because, well, it doesn't, it doesn't. If you think of it as a full circle, then in this moment, you're both practicing with the past implications of the sankharas that are coming and the present moment possibility that you could change the future. Can you see that? Every moment, that's what we are practicing with. The sankharas that are giving us the most difficulty, though, is this past cycle of suffering and the likelihood that that suffering is going to continue forevermore. So there's a way in which what I think Buddha was pointing to is our mental formations, our imprints, our habits, our fabrication, assumptions, this way of being, the way that we look at the world and we think the world is like this, that pushes us into the future. And the expectation that we're going to stay in it. So the mental formations, just a little bit of like a summary. I can't remember. I looked at my notes and I listened to Tim's talk and I thought, okay, just a little bit of a summary. These mental formations, they are connected to volition. So they're connected to our intentions to act, the intentions behind everything we do. But they are not the act itself. It's kind of strange because in Buddhism, intention and action are so intertwined together that the two are considered the same. They're so connected that we don't even see the intention, we just see the act itself. But really, it's the intention before we act that these mental formations are pointing to. There's an impulse to act before we act. And that's what we want to talk about, is that impulse, that precursor. They set in motion all of our actions. And they set in motion so much of our actions that by not seeing the impulse to act, we don't see the inevitable suffering we are now setting in motion yet again. That's going to come back around and we are again going to be setting in motion the same conditionality that Tim was talking about a couple weeks ago. So what we're trying to see when we are practicing with the sankharas is the impulse and pattern action, the pattern nature of our action. We're trying to see how habitual, without thought, how just automatic it is, so that we can begin to see that that automaticness, that pattern, that habit, that moving is not me. It's not you. It is the conditionality that we have created. And in this conditionality, we will continue on that path forever if we don't interrupt it. And this practice is designed to interrupt it. In fact, I was telling the Thursday night group, it's really just mindfulness is the only thing that interrupts it. That's what Buddha saw, that the interruption of the cyclical nature of stepping into this constant suffering gets interrupted when we apply mindfulness. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. But so the thing to begin to start our understanding is that the conditionality is what is, that's what reality is, not the mental formations. And we kind of have it backwards. We think what our mental formations tell us is happening, that's what reality is. So an example would be, I go to my sister's house. You know, I know how she is. She's arrogant. She's smart. She uses words that I don't even know what it means. So when I get there, it doesn't matter what actually happens. I am preceded by my already always thinking. Do you guys know the landmark educations? Well, landmark educations. I don't remember a lot about, I went through those series. I don't remember a lot about it. But the one thing that I remember is one of the phrases that they used to use is already always thinking. I think that is the best phrase in the world. So when I hit the door of my sister's house, I already have a way of looking at her. I already have a way of relating to her. And I always relate to her that way. I always see her that way. I know her. And who I know is the person I already always know. She already always knows me. So as soon as we walk in, my best plans, we're not gonna argue. I'm sitting in the car. Keep it steady, Tori. Remember your practice. We're just gonna go in there, be nice, whatever she says, roll it off. It takes about 2 minutes. That's what these sankharas are. The difficulty is I can't see in that moment that the thing I think that's happening between my sister and I is a conditionality. It's not reality. The reality is the conditioning I see. Reality is she's just acting that way. She's just arrogant. I got to learn how to just put up with her. I got to learn how to let her be her and I be me. I couldn't see her any other way. The sad part about it is it's so thick with us that even if my sister were on her own saying, okay, I'm not going to talk to Tori like that. I'm going to be different. It can't happen because I only see her one way. And my seeing her one way is going to create the dynamic that we always live in. That's what we're working with. So the only way to interrupt that is mindfulness. The only way to interrupt that already always being is through mindfulness and the practice of what the Buddha outlined in the Eightfold Path and Four Noble Truths. That's what we're going to talk about. But that is what we're working with. We're working with a life that lives in conditionality. And I'm emphasizing this so much so you'll feel like it's just not even worth it. It's just always going to be this way. It's not even worth it. You almost have to get to that level. Because if if we continue to live in the idea that we can somehow fix this situation. This is what I lived with my sister in practice. For years I practiced. And the whole idea was I was going to get myself better. I was going to be calmer, nicer. I'm not going to be reactive to her. We have to do the family dinners. There's no way I cannot go. So I'm going, but I'm not going to be reactive. And I kept trying to use this force of will to not be reactive. And I think what the sankharas are pointing to is you have to get to a place where you hit rock bottom and you recognize, I cannot stop this flow. I cannot stop this flow. And when you decide that you cannot stop the flow, then you're going to go a different way. And when you go a different way, it means instead of trying to prevent that which is already set in motion, you just start existing in a, it's like you're doing the right effort. Instead of not letting something happen, which doesn't make any sense, it's already set in motion to happen. Instead, if you notice some unskillful behavior has arisen, you abandon it right then. You don't try to not have it. Okay, I'm going to try to prevent it from arising, but if it arises, I'm going to abandon that, and I'm going to cultivate this skillful behavior and cultivate and sustain the skillful behavior that happens. So instead of me trying to exist in my sister's world together with her in this mental way that I'm thinking I should be, I stopped worrying about that. I gave it up, said, okay, it's not going to happen. I'm not even going to try to not argue with her. If I argue, that's okay. I'm going to try not to be unskillful. No harming, be as kind as I can, and let go of having to get my way. I cannot believe the amount of years I spent trying to not argue with that woman. And as soon as I just applied the mindfulness to just pay attention to what was actually happening, took me maybe a year, and the whole thing changed. I think that's what Buddha was pointing to, is for us to stop trying to make ourselves be a certain way, because that trying to make ourselves be a certain way keeps us locked in this inability to see the way we actually are. And it's our conditionality that's controlling us, not the idea of who we think we want to be and how we want to try to make our practice work. So let's talk a little bit about how we could practice with it. Because since we're talking about assumptions and habits and impulses, this is the impulse, the assumptions, the habits, the thing that pushes us and moves us ahead of time. Most of that is going to feel right. It's going to feel normal. It's conditioned. So in our everyday lives, the habitual way that we're moving through life, that's what feels normal. That's what feels right. That's the way it should be. And as long as everything's going along and nothing's going wrong, this feels right. This feels good. I'm doing good. This is skillful means. Everything's great. Everything's good. And as soon as something comes along that disrupts that natural flow, everything's going good, we think that thing that's interrupting it, that's the problem. Because everything else is good. I'm good. We're flowing along. never realizing that we're actually flowing in conditionality, creating at that, in that flow, the likelihood that we are going to be suffering, because all conditioned things are subject to change. And since all conditioned things are subject to change, and we are basing our lives on conditioned things, this idea that we can be in the flow and everything's going good and this is great, we're going along smoothly, that right there is delusion. That's what mental formations are trying to point to. The sankharas are trying to point to not just the things that we, the situations we get into where things don't get along, where things don't go right, but also this idea that we're just flowing along and life is going good and it's perfect. And then look, something came along and disrupted it. Everything was good and now it's wrong. We want to begin to see that. So I think any kind of practice that we do that points towards the mental formation, we're going to feel uncomfortable, it's going to feel abnormal, and we're going to have a lot of doubt. Then we know we're on the right track. We're going good, because as long as everything is smooth and going along, something's amiss. Something is, you got to almost question it, like, wait a minute. Not this idea from disassociation that, oh, I got to be worried if something good's going along because something bad's coming soon. Not that concept. But the willingness to understand that if we're living in conditionality, the idea of things flowing along good as a limited thing, that is real. It is limited because it's conditioned, and conditioned things change. Let me read a poem here. Tell you what I'm kind of pointing to. This is a poem by a person named Juan Ramon Jimenez. They say, I have a feeling that my boat has struck down there in the depths against a great thing. So I have a feeling that my boat has struck down there in the depths against a great thing. And nothing happens. Nothing. Silence. Waves. Nothing happens. Or has everything happened and we are now standing quietly in the new life? This is what I think we're aiming to see as we start practicing with this dependent origination. It's almost as if our practice is going to make things a little uncomfortable, a feeling like something has stuck here. We've stumbled upon something that's interrupted our natural flow. And if we just get still with that, not try to push through so we can keep going the way we've always gone, and instead, wait a minute. Do I have to do the same old, same old? In fact, the not same old, same old in relation to my sister was actually letting myself get mad and then just practicing with letting go of the anger. Instead of this constant flow of the way that we try to live a certain way, I actually begin to let my life just be the way it is. So this idea the first way we practice is to begin to practice with this understanding of the three characteristics. These things that the Buddha taught us are not secondary things over there, these lists. Instead, if you think about it, the three characteristics of this impermanence, the nature of dukkha because of that impermanence, the constant changing of things, and this non-self. Impermanence means that we let things flow. We let things change. We let things we disrupt the constant habitual nature of things. So I would do things like drive home a different way, catch a different bus and go all the way around. I used to catch the 27 and go up all the way up Yesler. I live up on Capitol Hill, so I have to come all the way around. There's a way in which we begin to disrupt this natural flow. And by disrupting disrupting this habitual flow, we move into the natural flow. We let things change and get comfortable with this natural flow. Because every time something gets lodged into this ability to just flow as it flows, we now have the opportunity to begin again. To begin again, to begin again, to begin again. So impermanence is what really reminds us that practice is about beginning again. It's not about making it right. It's about beginning again, seeing this habitual way of being, and then beginning again. The second thing is the natural suffering that we live through. It's almost like we can begin to see the dukkha that comes up in our life, the difficulty, the discomfort, the I don't like this. The beginning to see that suffering is the way life is supposed to be. I shouldn't say the suffering because it gets the words all mixed up. But the discomfort, the dissatisfaction, the things don't work, the something's going wrong. That is the way life is supposed to be. And that if we are not allowing life to be that way, we're somehow or another caught in the sankharas of this inevitable suffering. Instead, letting life just be a little messy is what we're trying to see if we can open up to. Allow the disjointedness of life to actually be the thing that helps us stay connected and keeps us from blaming other people, because we're no longer blaming ourselves, blaming other people. We're just letting life be as it is in this kind of quirky, disruptive, not always working way. And the last thing is, I think we kind of make this practice of non-self some kind of complicated intellectual thing. But I think Buddha told everybody non-self straight away. Just beginners coming in. Somebody stumbled in and said, oh, I heard something about Dhamma. What are you saying? He just talked about non-self. Because if you don't have an understanding that this is not about you, then everything you see that's disruptive and difficult and this isn't working, and we have to have the habits, because otherwise I'm not making my life good. So we get locked into these channels and expectations just so life can be good, because it's all about me. And I got to have a good life. And if I don't have a good life, then I messed up and I failed and something went wrong and I got to make it work. So instead of allowing life to just be free, we end up creating these silos to make it look good for me. So I'm going to be happy. But if we had some degree of trust And why would Buddha talk about these three characteristics of existence as the natural way life is? We could begin to use the awareness of suffering, the changing nature of everything, and this idea that it's not about me as a way to unhook ourselves from these habit patterns. So the three characteristics begin to be the thing I'm practicing with to unhook myself from this constant, habitual, impulsive way that we live. Without the three characteristics, we're going to naturally fall into this habit-conditioned world, trying to prop up the conditions in order for us to know that we're safe and secure. So the second thing is, since we're dealing with past causes, when we're talking about we haven't even got to the present moment situation here. We're still talking about the past implications that are pushing us towards suffering. So even though we're talking about something that's happening right now, you know, you go to work, you got this whole thing planned, you really got to get this project done, you're really going to go in there and get focused, you're ready, you're going to do it, and all of a sudden somebody comes in and disrupts that whole thing. And you're so irritated because you don't want to deal with that. You really got to get this project done, and the stress level is up here. So we try to push our lives into getting what it is that we want. What practicing with the sankharas to me means, if you look at it through the lens of the Four Noble Truths, then you want to begin to recognize suffering. You want to begin to recognize when my habit patterns are operating, and it's operating when you are not getting what you want. That's when our habit patterns are operating. Or on the flip side, you are getting what you want and you don't even know. You're so happy, you're just flowing. This is the way it's supposed to be. You don't even know that you're in the conditionality because you got what you want and everything's going good now. Everything's the way it's supposed to be. We're trying to see the suffering in that getting what I want and not getting what I want. How is it that the suffering is there? Beginning to see that there is a suffering in the wanting and the needing things to be a certain way in and of itself. That somehow, if we let life just be as it is, there's a liberation in that. I think that's what Supa was pointing to. She's saying in the eating whatever's offered, in the living wherever she can, that natural flow of allowing herself to be in the world as it is freedom. But because we are so afraid that we won't be safe unless we have it controlled here, we won't let ourselves see that. We won't know that there's a level of freedom when we let go of this idea of control. So the Four Noble Truths are really pointing us towards, if there is some degree of resistance and tension here, that resistance and tension isn't coming from the thing, the moment, the experience. It's coming from our relationship with it. And that relationship with it is our sankharas. It's the impulses, the volition, the pushing that's coming before us, trying to make the moment be the way we think it ought to be. And then the last thing has to do with putting our trust in what I would consider the practicalities of the Eightfold Path. So it's not just, it's like if we begin to see that the three characteristics are not just something to learn, it is the foundation of wisdom, because you can begin to see how things flow. That the Four Noble Truths are not just some Buddhist tenet that I should learn that. It's not a Buddhist tenet at all. It's just the way things are. So if you could just see it more connected to this is the way things are, then you could begin to open up to a whole new understanding. Likewise, the Eightfold Path is not just a practical application in my life. It's the practical way to see the mental formations. So you can begin to check in the wisdom side of it, what's my intention behind this? Whatever it is that's going on in this moment, if I'm trying to get something or I don't want something or I'm all happy, everything is going good, traffic is going smooth, what is that? I remember one time I was driving Venerable Potawatomi and Venerable Panadipa to Cloud Mountain, and you know, I left, got to leave to get to Cloud Mountain before 1 o'clock, and I didn't leave until like 2:30. Mostly because I had to get an oil change. Oh my God, I so totally regretted that. I don't know why it was such a big deal. I think it's because I planned, actually, let me think about it. I planned to get the oil change done before I picked them up at the airport. But then I found out that the time she gave me was not the time they came. They came in the morning. And then when I picked them up, they were hungry. So we go and eat breakfast. And I keep saying, I got to go get my oil change. So I'm insisting on doing what I want. But now I'm heading southbound I-5 at like almost 3. Oh, you can feel for me, can't you? So I would try to, I'm rushing now because they got to teach at Cloud Mountain that night. I'm rushing, I'm scooting in this lane and I'm scooting in that lane. But, you know, I got 2 monks in the car, so I'm trying not to look anxious. I'm trying to be all chilled. But really, I'm trying my best to go fast. And then there was this window when the traffic just cleared up, and I sped up because, you know, I like to go fast. And Panadipa says, "Whee!" It was hilarious. I lost it because that is exactly what I was feeling on the inside. Like, finally! that is sankhara. The sankharas, it's like to me the expectation is I should be able to go fast. I'm still living out of the 80s in Seattle. And it's not like that anymore. But I still live out of traffic like that. And I keep expecting any minute now, it's gonna break open and I'm gonna go fast. It's not happening. You gotta go early. So this, the learning to see what is underneath my behavior. What is that intention, the view? How am I looking at this moment? What's the intention behind what's going on? Is this about me? That's probably the best gauge if you want to know your intentions. Is this about me getting what I want? Is this about me not having to take something I don't want? In our ethical conduct, In our conduct, is there a way for me to just take the me out of it? If I just took the me out, what would happen? If it wasn't, if I didn't need to get my way, and I took the kind of, that's what greed and hatred is, that's the me aspect of a present moment. So if I took the me out, the greed out, the hatred out, and then just waited a moment and see what happens, what would happen? And then the actual capacity to do this, to take any given moment and notice how much meing is going on. We need the meditative qualities. We need that capacity to apply mindfulness and be still and wait. Just pay attention to what's happening. You don't have to fix your unskillful conduct. It's painful not to fix unskillful conduct, because we immediately want to fix it and pretend like, ooh, clean that up. Yes, that's not me. Ooh, that was scary. That get it all washed and cleaned, and that's not me. But it is much better to let that unskillful conduct be there and feel it, so you can feel how painful it is. And then you can begin to see, oh man, this is difficult, but we clean it up so quick, we don't see how difficult it is. So these sankharas, they show up in our thinking, they show up in our physical way that we act, and they show up in the way we talk. We want to see it. You want to be around people who care enough about you to tell you. We're not trying to be, it's hopefully we can let go of the need to fall down into the groove where everything is perfect and everything is good and I'm going along. And instead, we can get on the roughy wave side. You know how on Lake Washington, sometimes it's all smooth and the other side is all choppy. We want to be on the choppy side, the rocky, rolly, things are not going right side. Here's a poem that gets to what I'm pointing to. It's by Judy Surum Brown. It's called trough. It's kind of a weird word, this trough. It's not a black word. I don't use it. So I got to try to wrap my... do you know what a trough is? Okay, some of you do. I'm going to explain it here. In the poem, this is what she says. There is a trough in waves, a low spot where horizon disappears and only sky and water are our company. So there is a trough in waves. It's a low spot where horizon disappears and only sky and water are our company. And there we lose our way. Unless we rest, knowing the wave will bring us to its crest again. There we may drown if we let fear hold us within its grip and shake us side to side and leave us flailing, torn, and disoriented. But if we rest there in the trough, are silent, if we rest there in the trough and we are silent, being with the low part of the wave, keeping our energy and noticing the shape of things, the flow, noticing the shape of things, noticing the flow, then time alone will bring us to another place where we can see horizon, see the land again, regain our senses of where we are and where we need to swim. That's sweet. This is what it is that we're doing here with these sankharas, because the sankharas are so impactful in setting in motion suffering that's coming again in the future, that it's important that we get disruptive with it, which means that when we get disruptive, it's going to feel like a low part. It's going to feel like a dropping down low. Something's going wrong. Everything's all choppy. It's all shaken up. Life is not smooth and good anymore. And that, we got to stay with that. Choppy. Things are not going smooth. No, we're not going to follow the habit pattern. We're not going to keep everything the way things are. Then we have this possibility to see something completely new. See something we haven't seen before, because we're out of the habit groove. Mindfulness is what helps us do that. It means paying attention to what we're doing right now. And mindfulness takes us out of the habit, takes us out of the automatic following of impulses, the volitional kind of push that we just go through life with. And instead, we get in the choppy waters, but we may see some stuff we don't want to see. We may have to feel some stuff we don't want to feel. And it's just letting ourselves kind of go through the choppiness of all that. Go through the discomfort and the, I don't quite know how to be in this. I don't know if I can just be with the flow of things. I need to have a little bit more order. Just have to see what it's like to let the disruption of not doing things the habitual way and see what happens. So I'm going to end with this last poem or this last quote from one of the nuns. Her name is Rohini. It's called Wandering Star. This is what I think, this is what we're doing by stepping onto this path with dependent origination. She says, you don't become the cloth just because you put on robes. You don't turn into empty space just because you carry a bowl. The sun doesn't bow down. Trees don't throw flowers at your feet. Birds don't start answering when you call. The path will hold even the biggest mistakes. The path will make room for even your deepest regrets. And you don't become the cloth of the robe overnight. But you don't become the cloth of the robe overnight. It can begin very quietly, something you barely even notice, like the touch of water on your skin, like a knife in a drawer, like the next 5 minutes, unless they're your last. The path isn't a line on a map. It's a great shining world. Enter wherever you like. You might get thrown back once or twice, but if you push through the outer layers, oh, my sisters, then you will know the true welcome that is the very essence of the path. I don't think Rohini, she had to practice with some sankharas. You don't know what is possible on this path unless you're willing to practice in a way that will disrupt these habitual ways that we move through the world. These habitual, long-standing imprints that are in our minds. Unless we're willing to begin to take that on and challenge it, we can't see the shining world of liberation. So let's sit a moment or two and kind of digest some of this. Some of these poems are unbelievable. Thank you so much for your kind attention. I'll see if there's any questions. We're not even going to get to the present moment till next month, so that's kind of strange, but. Sure.
I'm kind of new to meditation, and you mentioned these things, but you didn't say what they were.
Mm. Good.
Is there a chart that you guys have?
Actually, there is a chart that used to go around. There's in this practice, there's a lot of list of things, and so. The Four Noble Truths, I didn't really, the three characteristics I kind of explained, it's impermanent and it's this nature of dukkha and non-self. And then the Four Noble Truths are, there's this truth of suffering, there's a truth that there's a cause to suffering, and the third truth is that there's a way to the cessation of suffering. And the fourth truth is the Eightfold Path, which is the way that leads to the end of suffering. So these, the actual Four Noble Truths and the three characteristics are part of what the Buddha taught when he was teaching how a person could move towards liberation.
And the Fourth Noble Truth has eight.
Yes.
Okay.
The fourth noble truth has eight parts to it. It's really, the fourth noble truth is really, there's a path that leads to the end of suffering. But that path is called the Eightfold Path. And that's the path that, it's just eight little aspects of how to practice with any given thing.
So we can do Wikipedia on.
Yes.
I have to get a chart.
Well, I guess what I want to encourage you is not to feel like, oh, I don't know all these terms in the practice, because you probably aren't the only one in the room that doesn't know all the terms, even if people have practice, because in the practice itself, there's meditation, which is just the technique of learning how to meditate. And then there are all these teaching theories, concepts, instructions that the Buddha gave on how to stay in your meditative practice. And that is a lot that many, many people who practice meditation don't necessarily know all the rest of it. So that's a pretty common understanding. I'm glad you actually ask me to explain it. Yeah. I'm so glad we have this mic. I can't even tell you. Okay, go ahead.
I'm not exactly sure how to phrase my question, but ever since coming this year to learn about dependent origination, I have been troubled by the thing about studying the past in this way? I mean, I understand the influence of the past, for instance, from a psychological point of view, very much, and it makes a lot of sense to me that way. But maybe I've been asleep all this time, but I honestly just never have heard in our teachings here much emphasis placed on looking at the past. It always, to me, has seemed like stay in the present, almost like there is no such thing as the past.
Oh, I see.
The past isn't really there because it's past.
Right.
And there really isn't a future because it's the future. The only thing that is real is what's right now.
Good. That's a good question.
And so I've just been so confused and twisted around in that sense about, like, why are we talking, how come we're talking about the past now all of a sudden? This is Buddhism, you know, it's not the past. I mean, psychology is the past, and psychology is all of this, and I understand psychology to a degree, but it has just thrown me for such a loop to hear you and Tim talking about the past with some sort of veracity, like, no, really, there is a past. And I just thought, wow, either I've missed it all this time, or I was hearing the wrong thing, or... anyway, I've just been kind of sitting here stumped lot of it, you know.
I'm glad you said this. I think what you're pointing to is so important, because the past, when we think of past in time, then the past is what was before and the future is what's coming. But in this practice, we're not talking about the past, what came before. We're talking about the past that has implications right now. We're talking about not, even though we have to talk about it as a past concept, the point of it is that past is pushing you in this present moment. And you need to see right now, right here, that implication. Because if you don't see the implication right here, right now, then right here, right now, you are creating the future that's going to turn around and be the exact same thing. So in this present moment, this is the window that we're operating in. This is the window that we're practicing in. It's not a psychological investigating how come I am like this because my past is like this. That's not what we're doing. We are looking in the present moment with the recognition that my past is pushing me forward to do the same thing over and over and over and over. That's what we're looking at. Not back there. We're looking at the past because it's right here. It's not back there. That's why in Buddhism there is no time. What this idea that the past is back there and I'm free of it is not true. No, we are in the past right here, and we are in the present right here, and we are in the future. But the only actual doorway into disrupting this continuous flow that goes for eons is in this present moment with mindfulness, recognizing this push that I feel to do something is not reality. It is my past pushing me to keep doing the same old, same old. That's what's happening. Can you see the difference? Or does it still feel like a psychological dwelling in the past? So another way to think about it is the psychological dwelling in the past is trying to figure out how the past is influencing me. Like the difficulties I had in childhood and how it's influencing me. That would be the psychological side of it. In the practice side of it, I need to feel my dysfunctionality right here, right now. So a way to think about it is, in the past, my concept of what was safe and not safe psychologically was messed up because my family was so chaotic. In the present moment, I'm not trying to understand the chaos of my past family dynamics. I'm trying to feel into this, I don't feel safe, and question the truth of that. Otherwise, that I don't feel safe pushes up against me and forces me into making decisions that are going to ensure that I don't feel safe again tomorrow, and I don't feel safe again tomorrow, and I keep doing the same thing, saying, oh, I don't understand. Everything is just, I want to feel safe, and I just keep doing the same thing, and I keep pushing the same thing. So instead, you want to use mindfulness right here, right now. Don't feel safe, but I'm going to double check and see, is it really that dangerous right here? What's actually happening? Oh, nothing's happening. I'm just sitting here. I feel this impulsive anxiety, energy, pushing, but really, I'm just right here. I'm just sitting here. Just still. I'm just going to see what happens. And most times, if we just are still, that impulse pushes, and then it like goes on to something else. Because it flows. But usually that push comes from the past, pushing into the present moment. We can experience it right here in the present moment. But instead of actually using the mindfulness to question it, investigate, get interested in this habit, we just follow the impulse into the future and back it goes again. So that's what we're doing. We are in the present moment. We're not dwelling on the past. We're just recognizing that the past is pushing on us to act a certain way. It's pushing on us to follow the same habits that we set in motion yesterday, 2 days ago. There's a Buddhist, I love the Tibetan's practice, in the 37 phrases, one of the phrases says, if you haven't tamed your thinking, then conquering foes will only make them increase. Right? Can you get that? So if you haven't tamed your own anger, every time you win the argument, there's a likelihood that you're going to have another argument coming. And you're going to have to win that one. And then that bolsters you. And then you got to win the next one. So every time you win an argument, you are ensuring that you're going to have to fight another one. And in taming the mind means some anger comes. There's an argument. And you're like, I'm going to let that go. And it feels like that is a wrong thing. I should be winning. But that going against the grain of that is what ensures that you can disrupt the flow of it. So that's what we're doing. We're actually practicing, as you say, in the present moment. But we're feeling the implications from our past actions. Yeah. Got to remember the mic.
On a relative level, the past happened, you know, like the last 70 years happened, which is why I'm 70. So, you know, it's not that it wasn't real.
I don't know whether it's real.
Well, I mean, you know, each day of that was the present moment, and now this is the present moment.
Yes.
But so...
I guess what I'm trying to say is...
I mean, I'm not disagreeing with anything
you said. I know what
you're
saying.
I'm just kind of speaking to.
I know. Yeah. That the past, as if somehow
it used to exist.
Yes, but I think you're that's the psychological aspect of it. Okay, so I'm probably going to say something that's way out. No. I'm going to tell you my own experience. That way we can keep it clean and skillful. I came from a lot of trauma. And psychologically, I carried that trauma every day of my life and created the same mess in my life that my parents created when I was living in their lives. Just this constant mess and mess and mess and mess. That is the psychological implications of trauma on your life in your present moment. That's not what we're doing with the Dhamma practice. We are feeling in the present moment the experience that's happening right here. But that experience is not the fact that my parents were volatile is not the truth of why I'm volatile right now. The truth of why I'm volatile right now is I want what I want and I don't want what I don't want. That's the truth of it, and that's it. But if I win my argument from whatever volatile thing I do, you can bank I'm going to do that again. And I'm going to keep doing that. What the practice is trying to get us to do is not psychologically unhook myself from my parents. As far as the practice is concerned, I think that's literally irrelevant. Because what's relevant is in this moment, I am acting out in an unskillful way, and I want to feel that. The reason why this is difficult is because it is much, speaking from someone who's had such a negative childhood, it was much easier for me to just lay all the blame back there and not really have to deal with the mess that I'm actually doing right now. In the practice, you can't do that. You have to take responsibility here and now for what you are doing, and you are not, it's not my parents doing it. And it's not even my parents' dysfunctionality that's forcing me to do it. It is learning to be okay with noticing my own dysfunctional, unskillful behavior in and of itself. So in that way, the past is irrelevant, but you have to begin to see that that past is showing up right now. So I'm going to keep doing dysfunctional, unskillful, harmful things if I don't begin to interrupt this flow of the past into my life, into the future. That's what we're really, and the only way to do that is non-self. You have to take this out of the context of this is Tiwari doing this. And it's got to be, this is a habit that needs to be disrupted. And applying the skillful efforts of abandoning unskillful, you know, vowing not to do it again and cultivating the skillful and trying to sustain it. Just like a little orchestra. You got a little tiny instruments right here. We're just doing it right here. We're not doing it all out here. We're just working it right here. That's all we're doing. And in that present moment, that's what I think the nun was pointing to. It's very tiny things that are almost unnoticeable. Little tiny things that are almost unnoticeable because you're just working with your little orchestra right here. But it has big, huge implications. Yeah, one more and we're going to be done.
I wonder about a potential to, if you're feeling really uncomfortable, so you figure out, oh, I'm being pushed by my habit into doing something that I don't want to keep doing. So my tendency, I think, would be to, the next thought would be to get down on myself about that.
Yes. That down on yourself is a normal response for us because we think we think it's about us. So if we see some habit, we think it's saying something about me. Like, oh, I'm doing something. But the idea is to begin to see it's not you doing it. It is a habit doing it. And the mindfulness and the concentration, the meditative qualities is to help you stay steady with it and not follow the impulse of it and not follow the beating yourself up about it. That's a habit. So just the steadiness of beginning to see these disruptive difficulties is all we're really trying to do. But you won't know that steadying yourself and letting the moment just be there without all the judgment, you won't know the liberative quality of that until you do it. But usually as soon as we see ourselves doing a habit, we get caught up in all the mental papancha about it and will likely increase that habit coming back again. So anyway, I gotta stop. I just wanna say one thing before you go, is that I won't be here, but Venerable Panawati is coming next weekend, I think it is. So I hope you will go see her. Not this weekend.
Right. It's the 6th, 7th, 8th.
Yeah, so it's next weekend. So I just want to encourage you to go and see if anybody needs a ride. We're all good. Well, thank you so much. Tim is going to bring us into the present moment. Debbie. So that we can start talking about consciousness. We haven't even got to the conscious knowing what's going on yet. So we're going to start that next month. All right? So thank you very much.